The pub was steamy with body heat. The condensation ran down the stained glass windows in rainbow rivulets. Michael displayed the carnations ostentatiously and peered through the soft blue mist of tobacco smoke. Almost immediately, a neatly dressed Indian in a three-piece blue wool suit left the bar counter and made his way down the crowded room.
Mr. Courtney, my name is Govan.
From Natal, Michael recognized the accent.
From Stanga,
the man smiled.
But that was 6 years ago.
He glanced at the shoulders of Michael's coat.
Has it stopped raining?
Good, we can walk.
It's not far.
His guide struck out down the main thoroughfare. Within 100 yards, he turned abruptly into a narrow alleyway and increased his pace. Michael had to trot to match him. He was wheezing when they reached the exit to the alley.
Damned fags, I must cut down.
Govan turned out of the alley and stopped abruptly around the corner. Michael was about to speak, but Govan gripped his arm to silence him. They waited for 5 minutes. Only when it was certain that they were not being followed did he relax his grip.
You don't trust me,
Michael smiled, and dumped the carnations in the rubbish bin that bore a warning of the penalties for littering.
We do not trust anybody,
Govan led him away, especially not the Boers. They are learning new kinds of nastiness each day. 10 minutes later, they stopped again outside a modern block of flats in a broad, well-lit street. There was a rank of Mercedes and Jaguars parked at the curb. The lawn and small garden in front of the apartment block was carefully groomed. It was clearly an expensive residential enclave.
I will leave you here, said Govan. Go in. There is a porter in the lobby. Tell him that you are a guest of Mr. Kendrick, flat 505.
The lobby was in keeping with the facade of the building. Italian marble floor, wood-panelled walls and gilded doors to the lift. The uniformed porter saluted him.
Yes, Mr. Courtney, Mr. Kendrick is expecting you. Please go up to the fifth floor.
When the lift doors opened, there were two unsmiling young coloured men waiting for him.
Come this way, Mr. Courtney.
They led him down the carpeted passage to number 505 and let him into the flat. As the door closed, they stepped in on each side of him and swiftly but thoroughly patted him down. Michael lifted his arms and spread his legs cooperatively. As they searched him, he looked around him with the journalist's eye. The flat had been decorated with flair and taste and money. His escort stepped back satisfied, and one of them opened the double doors ahead of him.
Please, he said,
and Michael went through into a spacious and beautifully decorated room. The sofas and easy chairs were covered with cream-coloured Connolly leather. The thick pile of the wall-to-wall carpet was a soft cocoa. The tables and the cocktail bar were in crystal and chrome. On the walls hung four large Hockney paintings from his swimming pool series.
£50,000 each, Michael estimated.
And then his eyes flicked to the figure who stood in the centre of the room. There had been no recent photograph of this man, but Michael recognized him instantly from a blurred press picture in the Mail's archives, which dated back years to the Sharpeville era and the subsequent inquiries.
Mr. Tabaka, he said.
He was as tall as Michael, probably 6'1", but broader in the shoulder and narrower in the waist.
Mr. Courtney,
Raleigh Tabaka came forward to offer his hand. He moved like a boxer, fluidly and balanced, poised, and aggressive.
You live in style,
Michael put a question in his voice, and Raleigh Tabaka frowned slightly.
This is the apartment of a sympathizer. I have no call for such frippery.
His voice was firm and deep, melodious with the unmistakable echoes of Africa. Despite the denial, his suit was of pure new wool and draped elegantly over his warrior's frame. There were the tiny stirrups of the Gucci motif on his silk tie. He was an impressive man.
I'm grateful for this opportunity to meet you, Michael said.
I read your Rage series,
Raleigh told him, studying Michael with those black onyx eyes.
You understand my people. You examined their aspirations with a fair and impartial eye.
And not everybody would agree with you, especially those in authority in South Africa.
Raleigh smiled. His teeth were even and white.
I have very little to tell you that will comfort them now, but first may I offer you a drink?
Oh, it's a gin and tonic. Yes, please. Thank you.
Ah, yes.
The fuel on which the journalistic mind functions. Raleigh's tone was scornful. He went to the bar and poured the clear liquid from a crystal decanter and squirted the tonic from a hand-held nozzle connected to the bar by a chrome-sheathed hose.
You don't drink? Michael asked, and Raleigh frowned again.
With so much work to be done, why should I cloud my mind?
He glanced at his wristwatch.
We have only an hour, then I must go.
I mustn't waste a minute of it, Michael agreed, as they settled facing each other in the cream Connolly leathered chairs. He said, I have all the background I need, your place and date of birth, your education at Waterford School in Swaziland, your relationship to Moses Garmer, your present position in the ANC. May I go on from there?
And Raleigh inclined his head in assent.
The term terrorist is generally applied to...
Michael repeated his definition, and Raleigh's features tightened with anger as he listened.
There are no innocent bystanders in South Africa, he cut in brusquely. It is a war. Nobody can claim to be neutral. We are all combatants.
No matter how young, how old, no matter how sympathetic to your people's aspirations,
there are no bystanders, Raleigh repeated. From the cradle to the grave, we are all in the battlefield. We all fall into one of two camps, either the oppressed or the oppressors.
No man or woman or child has a choice? Michael asked.
Yes, there is one choice, to take one or the other side. Neutrality is not an option.
If a bomb explodes in a crowded supermarket, some of your own people, your own sympathizers, may die or be maimed. Would you feel remorse?
Remorse is not a revolutionary emotion, just as it is not an emotion of the perpetrators of apartheid. Those who die are either enemy casualties or courageous and honorable sacrifices. In war, both are unavoidable, even desirable.
Michael's pen dashed across the sheets of his notepad as he attempted to capture these frightful pronouncements. He felt shaken and aroused, both excited and terrified by what he heard. He had the feeling that, like a moth that circled the flame too closely, he would be scarred by the white heat of this man's rage. He knew that he could faithfully record the words, but he could never reproduce the fierce spirit in which they were uttered. The allotted hour sped away far too fast, as Michael tried to use every second to the full, and when at last Raleigh glanced at his wristwatch and stood up, he tried desperately to prolong it.
You have spoken of your child warriors, he said. What age? How young are they? I will show you children of 7 who will bear arms, and commanders of sections who are 10 years old.
You will show me? Michael asked. Is that possible, that you will show me?
Raleigh studied him for a long time. The intelligence that Ramon Machado had passed on to him seemed to be valid. Here was a useful tool, one that could be fitted to his hand and his purpose. He might be well worth the effort that would be needed to develop him fully. He was one of Lenin's so-called useful idiots, who to begin with could be made to serve the cause unwittingly. Later, of course, it would be different. At first he would be the spade and the ploughshare. Only later, when the time was ripe, would he be forged into the sword of war.
Michael Courtney, he said softly. I am disposed to trust you. I think that you are a decent and enlightened man. If you keep my trust, I will open doors for you in places you have never dreamt existed. I will take you into the streets and hovels of Soweto, into the huts of my people. And yes, I will show you the children.
When? Michael demanded anxiously, aware that his time was running out.
Soon,
Raleigh promised, and at that moment they heard the front door open.
Well, how will I find you? Michael persisted.
You won't. I will find you when I am ready.
The double doors to the sitting room swung open, and a man stood at the threshold. Even in his preoccupation with Raleigh Tabaka's promise, Michael was struck. His attention was diverted. He recognized the newcomer instantly, even in his street clothes. The name Kendrick should have alerted him.
This
is our host who owns this apartment, Raleigh Tabaka introduced them. Oliver Kendrick, this is Michael Courtney.
I saw you dance Spartacus, Michael said, his voice subdued with awe. Three times. Such virility and athleticism.
Oliver Kendrick smiled and crossed the room with the springing gait of the ballet dancer, and offered Michael his hand. It was surprisingly narrow and cool, and his bones felt light as those of a bird. It was appropriate, for they called him the Black Swan. His neck was long and elegant as that of a bird, and his eyes were as luminous as a mountain pool reflected in the moonlight. His skin had the same dark luster. Michael thought that close up he was more beautiful even than he had appeared in the romantic lighting of the stage set, and his breathing cramped. The dancer left his hand in Michael's grip as he turned his head to Raleigh.
"Oh, don't rush away, Raleigh," he pleaded in the musical West Indian lilt.
"I must go," Raleigh shook his head. "I'm afraid that I have a plane to catch." Oliver Kendrick turned back to Michael, still holding his hand.
"I've had a beastly day. I swear I could simply curl up and die. Don't leave me alone, Michael. Do stay and distract me. You can be entertaining and distracting, can't you, Michael?"
Raleigh Tabaka left him and let himself out of the flat. One of his men was waiting for him outside the door, but they did not leave the building. Instead, the man led Raleigh only a short distance down the passageway to a less ostentatious doorway. This second flat, beyond it, was much smaller and starkly furnished. Raleigh went through to the inner room, and the second of his men made to stand up from the chair beside the lit window in the side wall. Raleigh gestured to him to remain seated and crossed to the window. It was of unusual shape, tall and narrow, like a full-length dressing mirror. The glass was shaded with that slightly opaque tone that was characteristic of a two-way mirror viewed from the reverse side. The room beyond was a bedroom, lavishly furnished like the rest of Oliver Kendrick's apartment. The colour theme was pale oyster and mushroom, and the satin bedspread matched exactly the shade of the deep pile of the carpet. Hidden lighting glimmered and glowed on the mirrored tiles of the ceiling. Set in an alcove facing the bed was an ancient phallic symbol, carved from amber-coloured obsidian, a precious antique from a Hindu temple. The room was empty, and Raleigh turned his attention to the camera equipment that stood ready, aimed through the two-way mirror. The apartment and the camera equipment belonged to Oliver Kendrick. He had loaned it to Raleigh on previous occasions. It was odd that a man of Kendrick's talent and fame would consent to take part in an arranged tableau such as this. However, not only did he do so willingly, but he had also actually offered his equipment and his services to Raleigh. He participated with such unfeigned enthusiasm and inventive delight that it was obvious that this was very much to his particular taste. His only stipulation was that Raleigh hand over to him a copy of the videotapes and photographs to add to his huge private collection. The video equipment was one of the very finest professional standard. Raleigh had been impressed by the quality of reproduction even in this low-light environment. Raleigh glanced at his wristwatch again. He could safely leave the rest of it to his two bodyguards. They had done this before. However, a perverse curiosity made him linger. It was almost half an hour before the door to the bedroom opened. Kendrick and Michael Courtney entered. Raleigh's two assistants moved quickly to their positions, one to the video recorder and the other to the big black Hasselblad camera on its tripod. The still camera was loaded with monochrome theatrical film rated at 3000 ASA, which rendered crisp prints in the poorest light conditions. In the room beyond, the two men embraced. A long, lingering kiss with open mouths, and the video recorder emitted a faint electric hum. The sound of the shutter of the Hasselblad was much louder, almost explosive in the quiet, dark room. At one stage, as the white man lay expectantly in the centre of the oyster satin bedspread, Kendrick crossed naked to stand in front of the two-way mirror. He pretended to examine his own body, in reality flaunting it before the men who he knew were watching on the far side of the glass. His musculature was extraordinarily developed by long hours at the practice bar. His calves and thighs were disproportionately massive. He gazed arrogantly into the mirror, and the diamond earrings in his lobes glittered as he turned his head on its long swan's neck, striking a theatrical pose. He ran the tip of his tongue along the inside of his parted lips, and stared through the darkling mirror into Raleigh Tabaka's eyes. It was the lewdest gesture he had ever witnessed, with a chill of evil to it that made even Raleigh shiver briefly. Kendrick turned away and sauntered back towards the bed. His velvety black buttocks swayed in that stylized, mincing gait, and the man on the bed raised both arms to greet him. Raleigh turned away and left the apartment. He rode down in the lift and walked out into the chill of evening. He drew his overcoat tighter across his chest and took a slow breath of clean, cold air. Then he gathered himself and walked away with the long, determined stride of a man with important work to do.